Okay, I'm supposed to do this in 12 minutes. Okay, it's going to be a challenge, but I'll try. My name is Amin Oda, and I'm with Voices of Palestine. We're a local organization that started in the year 2000 when the second Intifada started in Palestine. I'm also with the Arab American Community Coalition here in Seattle. It's also a local organization that we founded after 9/11, a few days after 9/11. Just listening to Jess describe how the FBI came to their house and they knocked at the door reminded me of when the Israeli army came to arrest my brother, but they didn't knock at the door. They knocked the door down. And I just, while she's speaking, it's like living through that nightmare and hoping and praying that we don't get to that point here. That we cannot let them get away with this. Because they're going down the same road. Exactly like the Colombian government, the Egyptian government, and we just cannot let them do this. My first experience with, talking about the relationship between our federal government and the Israeli government and sharing records, like you mentioned, with the Israeli, the American, or, well, they're the same government. But the U.S. government and the National Civilian Police, it's different. Hearing about it is different than actually seeing it. And in 1990, when I was doing my paperwork to come here, at my final interview at the consulate in Jerusalem, the interview actually turned from an interview to almost an interrogation. And my shock, and this is where you when you come face to face with this and see how much they share information, the official from the consulate who was doing the interview or conducting the interview had the same questions, almost my answers from the interrogation session that I had at the Israeli interrogation room or with the Shin Bet. I mean, I understand they get your you do a background check. They're supposed to know who's coming here, but for them to know that much information, that information that was only mentioned in the interrogation room, it's very scary. So coming here to that, when they finally approved it with some serious, warnings, it wasn't intimidation or anything, but it was, just to let me know that they're watching me. When I arrived here in Seattle, I had another interview. It was an interrogation session. It was just an interview, but it was the same thing, similar warnings. And that was in 1990. It wasn't after 9/11. It wasn't, a month ago after the toner cartridges. This has been happening to many activists, and it's not new. So I wasn't surprised when I actually heard about these final raids. It's happening under Obama, and this is something that I'm sure we can take this to another discussion. But it's the same federal government, and I know many of us are disappointed that Obama's allowing this. And in fact, this afternoon I was discussing this with my wife, talking about this meeting, and my 16-year-old daughter said, "Does Obama know?" I get this question when I go speak about Israel-Palestine at high schools and colleges, and many kids would ask me, well, does our government know about this? When I talk about Israeli war crimes. Many people out there don't know, and this should be our job, to let people know that this is happening, not just to troublemakers. I mean, they try to make us look like we're all troublemakers. We're all, anti-government, we're just different, and it's to make it easier for people to accept this. So when I living here in the 90s, it wasn't as bad. And like just mentioned, thank God there was no Patriot Act in the 80s or the 90s, because things changed after the Patriot Act. And I'm sure Neil can talk more about this. So when we activists who were, living under military occupations, we always looked at you guys and said, that you're so lucky that you're living in the States. they won't shoot you. You won't go to jail forever because you're just raising a flag or, you know, speaking out against an oppression or an oppressed government. It's not anymore. I mean, this is changing, and it's sad to see this changing, and people are allowing this. So it's a big risk that it's very dangerous for all of us, and it's one of the reasons that I tell people that I do this. It's just I don't want my kids growing up here to be dealing with this, to live under a similar oppression or occupation that I lived under for most of my life. So this is one of the reasons why I do what I do, knowing that they could detain me any day. It would be much easier for them. I mean, with my record, I could be deported. I could be sent to Guantanamo. I could be sent to a black jail in black prison in Eastern Europe. And this is, believe me, this is not a conspiracy. I'm sure many of you know this. They exist. So what just mentioned about the way they were, these activists were, how their homes were raided. This has been happening on daily basis with the Arab and Muslim community. Thousands of people were detained and either deported or disappeared, or they were released with their lives ruined because you're a suspect. Your neighbor doesn't trust you anymore. You'll be fired from your job, and your life is over. So it's been happening to us since 9/11, and I will tell you about a couple of cases that we took. I mean, with the other organization that I'm part of, the Arab American Community Coalition, we're a local group. We're all volunteers, and we decided to do this for the reasons I mentioned. We just refused to allow the government to do this to us, and we. Many of our community members who were active before 9/11, unfortunately decided to stop because they were afraid that they're going to be detained or deported or they'll be a target. Our argument with them was, you know, you're a target regardless. Your background, your color, your skin color, your name, you're a suspect. After the Patriot Act, I mean, all of us, everybody who criticizes the government is a target. So we decided to continue, knowing that this could happen to any of us. But I agree with Jess, it's worth it for us to make it better for us or for our children and grandchildren. We cannot let them get away with this. Thank you. And we started a hotline. We answer the phone 24 hours. We're the first organization to start a hotline and in three languages: English and Arabic, Persian, and Urdu. And it was interesting. After 9/11, we were afraid that it's going to be just the public reacting to this. So we had so much hate towards us, you know, from mainly ignorant people. And it died down after the first few months. It changed. But what was interesting, that it picked up again from the government. It wasn't the public. I think the public just, it was a reaction to what they saw and dealt with. We understood why. It doesn't mean we accepted all this hate. But it was just, the scary part was how much the government did to us after that. And, you know, a couple of cases that I'm going to mention that we were involved in, one of them was here, one of them was in Florida, where another Palestinian-American activist who was living here for 30 years, a legal resident, and he was active mainly on the with a focus on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but he was also active in his own community, organizing, and they decided that he was financing Islamic Jihad and Hamas and other organizations. Came to his house, picked him up, and it was announced that even in Moscow by John Ashcroft that they got the head of Islam, you know, the American Islamic Jihad. This is a professor living here in Florida for 30 years, doing everything in the open. But this is where it was after the Patriot Act. I mean, they did not have to prove anything. We're all suspects here until proven guilty. I mean, it's just very scary. After 4 years in jail, we helped raise some funds for him and his family. After he was ordered to released, they still kept him in jail. I mean, this is here in the States. A judge ordered him released. The Justice Department decided to keep him in for almost another year and a half. Then they released him, and he's under house arrest. He's still under house arrest. There was a hearing about a few days ago, and he's going to be forced to testify in front of a grand jury against people who he worked with in some nonprofit organizations. Many of them doing some work to support orphans and rebuild homes destroyed in Palestine. And it's not over yet for him. Another case where a Saudi gentleman who was here at the UW working at the School of Nursing, he applied for he was here for about, I think as a student, tried to change his status, applied for a change of status. His application was pending. He was legal. Well, what I didn't know with Majid is that his dad was also on a watch list by the Saudi government in the UK. The same week they picked up his dad because of something that he did or said, they picked up Majid, and in less than a month he was deported to Saudi Arabia. This guy was well known at the UW. He did everything in the open, but all what he did was activism, and most of it was criticizing the occupation, the Israeli occupation, the U.S. occupation of Iraq, and the Saudi government. He was deported in less than a month without any, going through the legal system. So it is happening to all of us, to many of the Arabs and Muslims, and now it's happening to you. So I hope when you go home tonight, you think about this, that it's not just Arabs and Muslims who are going through this. If we don't act now, we're going to be all looked at and treated the same way. Thank you.
Hello, I guess I'm the designated historian here tonight. What I want to explain to you is that what you're hearing tonight is nothing new. This has been a part of the American political process ever since there has been. It is ironic, though they probably didn't know it, that I am also a wobbly for 40 years, member of the IWW and the FBI. Started off their little political anti-activism in part to crush the organization that I belong to, and I knew some of those old-timers that spent time in federal prisons, state prisons, for nothing more than taking out a union card. That's all they did. Matter of fact, in California, they got so tired of having trials of wobblies and sending them to prison, a judge came up and said, okay, I'm going to put out an order that if you're a member of the IWW, you're in contempt of court. And so all they would do is bring them into the courtroom, show that they are a member of the IWW, and off to San Quentin. With me personally, I got involved back in the late 60s and early 70s, and one of the things I got involved with was radical journalism. I was part of a newspaper that came out weekly, circulation 10,000, called the San Diego Street Journal, and they decided that we were one of the targets that the FBI was focusing on back in those days. One of the reasons was that we got into muckraking corrupt politicians and corporations and whatnot. We were responsible of getting Nixon's biggest campaign contributor busted and sent to prison. So they really disliked us. They shot at us. They bombed us. I was arrested 6 times in 1 year. They infiltrated us. And what they do, the thing that you got to understand about the FBI is that they don't always do things out in the front like raid your home and put you in front of a grand jury. They'll go after your families. They'll go after your jobs. They'll go after any way that they feel that they can affect you, any way that they feel they can break you. And if you start feeling weak or showing signs of weakness or withdrawing from what you're doing, they'll go after you stronger until they can force you maybe to join their side and testify against other people. So you only have one choice if you're going to be an activist, and that is stay strong. Well, us in San Diego, it was a continuous thing. We had to have 24-hour armed guards on our three houses, because the other thing that they did is that they infiltrated the militaristic right wing, an organization called the Minutemen. It's not the same organization you know today, but it was a right wing paramilitary organization back then, which practiced terrorism on us, and we had to defend ourselves. Well, eventually, the FBI decided that the Minutemen were not radical enough for them. They weren't shooting and bombing us quite enough. So the FBI itself, its field agents, created an organization called the Secret Army Organization, which escalated the violence against activists. Not just the journalists like us, but the anti-war movement and everything else in San Diego. There's a professor down at Evergreen by the name of Peter Bomer who went through a lot of that I knew back in those days. After the Street Journal, you get on their lists and get tagged by them. There's no retirement. You don't just ease away from the movement. They continue their persecution of you. With me, they went after my family, my kids. I have one murdered son because of them. And I went through a trial process that took me through the 70s. Well, one of the things that we discovered back in San Diego was that there were particular FBI agents that seemed to specialize in this. There was one particular FBI agent by the name of Richard Held. Now, this guy was involved in the suppression of the Panthers in San Diego. He was involved in the suppression of the Panthers in Los Angeles. He was involved in the murder and cover-up of Fred Hampton. Then later he came to San Diego, and he was the one that supervised and created the Secret Army Organization against us. He then, after that, went to Puerto Rico and practiced his trade there. And then after that, he went to Pine Ridge. And he was involved in the persecution of Leonard Peltier. Not only am I wobbly, but I have been working for Leonard Peltier continuously since 1979. I'm the Northwest Community Organizer for the Leonard Peltier Offense-Defense Committee, which is out of South Dakota. And I have been organizing, many of you know me from the rallies that I've organized for Leonard continuously over the years here. We've had 63 rallies since 1992. The thing about Leonard's case, which is so important when you think in terms of the FBI and everything, is here was a person that got in the way of a governmental scheme, an illegal scheme, and that was uranium on the Black Ridge, on the Pine Ridge Reservation. They discovered the uranium in the northwest corner, and then they had to find a way to get this land away from the Lakota people. The Lakota people up to that point had refused to take money for the Black Hills that had been stolen long before then, and they sure the hell weren't going to take money for more of their land to be stolen. They knew that. So they went about with a plan to suppress the traditional people of the Pine Ridge Reservation. This included death squads. This included whole villages that they would go in and shoot up. This included fraudulent tribal elections and everything where they put people in power that would do their bidding. Well, Leonard and some of the native activists of that time stood up to it. And Unfortunately, there was a situation where the FBI came into their encampment in the same way that the drive-by shootings had been occurring on Pine Ridge in the last few years before that. Over 63 people had been murdered up until that point. They had real reason to fear for their lives. This was death squads like you heard about in El Salvador and other places, but in South Dakota. The same thing was happening. And in my opinion, the same people, the same mentality. Well, Leonard and these people stood up by it. These cars came up. There was a firefight, and two FBI agents died on that day, and one AIM warrior died on that day, Joe Stuntz. Everybody got away for some reason, even though the FBI says that this was not something planned by them. They had over 200 agents there within an hour shooting at them. We also found out later that all the roads going into the area had been blocked before the shootout happened. All the local hospitals have been notified to expect casualties before the shootout happened. So we know that this was planned. And if anybody's responsible for the death of those agents, it's the FBI itself for turning them in like that. So Leonard went through a period of time where he was on the run and then was finally arrested. He was brought back to the United States when the United States government lied to the government of Canada and presented falsified evidence to them that they knew was false. He was tried and convicted after the original two members were found not guilty for reason of self-defense. His trial was moved to North Dakota illegally, by means that nobody knows, to a judge that ruled everything against, including self-defense, against the Leonard and his defense, and he was found guilty. Later on, through the Freedom of Information Act, we found that the ballistics report was fabricated by the FBI. We found that witnesses were intimidated. We got to the point where the government prosecutor came up and said, "We don't know who shot the agents on that day. Leonard was just there." We have disproved all the evidence against Leonard, but still, we ain't got to the point where the court has come out and stated that the government abused power, intimidated witnesses and everything. We still can't get a new trial. So we have coming up a new struggle of clemency for Leonard from President Obama as soon as it gets to his desk. There's a process there. Well, the last thing that I want to say to you all these cases that you've heard about tonight are important. When you hear about some case of suppression of an activist, it's important for you to come out and support those people, Leonard or anybody else. Not just because you feel for what those people come out have gone through, but because you're doing it for yourselves. You got to understand that everything that all these people gone through, every one of you could at some point go through, because the government and the FBI does not care about principles of freedom. They care about only their political agenda and supporting the established quo. And if you speak out against that, you are a threat. And the only way to stand up to that, there's only one possible way. And that is when you come out in the public and build a movement against that, when you show that the people will not put up with it, they will stop, because they'll see that their actions is creating a solidarity movement in this country that there is no way that they can suppress. Thank you very much.
Good evening. I'm Neil Fox from the National Lawyers Guild, and I want to start by saying to Jess next to me that my heart goes out to her, because there's nothing that I can say as a lawyer that can match the pain and mental anguish that she must be going through. And I'm honored to be sitting next to you, but my heart really goes out to you. last week, I was riding my bicycle through downtown Seattle, and I went past the Sheraton Hotel at the corner of 6th and Pine, or Pike, and I saw six uniformed Nazis outside that hotel. These were six people. They had these blue uniforms with patches with swastikas on them. And they were actually there protesting against the Anti-Defamation League. It's very bizarre, because the first thing that I noticed were their signs. We're saying that, which is true, that the Anti-Defamation League has a blind spot towards Palestine. And I'm like looking at these signs, and I'm looking at the people that are holding them. And I realize that there are six Nazis who have the chutzpah to be in downtown Seattle. There are two older people about my age with no armbands, but they were kind of directing things. But there were Nazis downtown Seattle, and I just started screaming at them. I screamed at them in German, but they didn't understand German. But you know, that they would crawl out from underneath their rocks and come to our city. This is not Coeur d'Alene. This is not Hayden Lake. This is not Whidbey Island, where Matthews had his shootout with the FBI 25 years ago. This is downtown Seattle. And that they felt that they had the safety and that they had the comfort level to come to our city and be out there with swastikas on their arms made me realize that we are in a very, very dark time. They were emboldened by the Tea Party, by those people that we think are laughable, really. But those people are a nascent fascist movement, and it is very, very scary. And in these dark times, our president's response is to move to the center. That's his response. He thinks that that's where he can keep his power. And what I think that these raids that have taken place in the Midwest mean, it really means that despite the fact that Obama was elected by the majority of people in this country who wanted a change from the last few years of the Bush policies, that what it means is that when you get into power, even if you are the most progressive president, so-called, that we've had for many, many years, that the institutions control the people in power, that the institutions are there to promote a capitalist agenda, and that when you take power, even if you're progressive, that your destiny is set by those institutions. You may have the best of intentions, but those institutions are very powerful, and they will direct you. I had a friend who I used to work with at the Public Defenders who said that if Nelson Mandela was head of the King County Jail, it would still be the King County Jail. It's true, because those institutions drive what those people do. And so even when you have Obama in power, you have Eric Holder, they have no problems reaching back to the most repressive tools adopted by prior administrations. And the material support statute is one of those tools. They have no problems using those tools to advance what they think is their political agenda. And in fact, those tools are there, and they're going to use them. We know they're going to use them. But the material support statute, and now I guess I have to be a lawyer and I have to talk about the law. The material support statute was adopted during the Clinton years. The earlier forms of it were adopted as part of the far-reaching Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. This statute, passed by the Democrats, contained a series of very repressive tools. Apart from gutting the right of habeas corpus in federal courts, the material support statute was part of that as well. It was refined after 2001, and it has been the primary tool used originally by the Bush administration against the Arab American community, as we've heard. There was a charitable organization called the Holy Land Foundation that raised money for children and people affected by the Israeli occupation in Palestine, and that organization, people that were supporters of that organization, administrators of that organization, people were prosecuted, the organization was shut down, and is really decimated. That was what was going on in this country in the early 2000s. This statute makes it a federal crime to knowingly provide material support or resources to a foreign terrorist organization. Well, it sounds, well, foreign terrorist organization, material support. You imagine that what it means is that someone's sending guns off to terrorist groups, right? Well, wrong. First off, what's a foreign terrorist organization? How do we know what a foreign terrorist organization is? Well, the statute allows the Secretary of State to designate what foreign terrorist organizations are. This isn't something that's voted on. This isn't something, I mean, it's on the internet. You can look it up on the U.S. Department of State website, and there's a list of them. But the list is very political in nature. Groups go in and out of this list over time to satisfy American foreign policy goals. Okay, and that's the reason why the Secretary of State has control over this, because this law is supposedly a foreign policy tool. But it's confusing. I mean, there are some groups on here that people would, you know, Al-Qaeda would probably qualify. But then you have, for instance, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. This is a Marxist organization that has been within the PLO, sometimes actively and sometimes not actively, but been a core part of the PLO for years. Well, the PLO is recognized internationally as a legitimate representative of the Palestinian people, and Fatah is the main party in the PLO, is in power in the West Bank. So by supporting the PLO, do you support the PFLP? I mean, how do you know? How do you know? The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade is on the list. That's part of of Fatah, which is in power in the West Bank. I mean, it's very vague. But once you get over the hurdle of figuring out what groups are terrorist organizations, then the question is, what's material support? What does that mean? Well, I'll just read from the statute. The term material support or resources means any property, tangible or intangible, or service, including currency or monetary instruments or financial securities, financial services, lodging, training, expert advice or assistance, safe houses, false documentation or identification, communications equipment, facilities, weapons, lethal substances, explosives, personnel, one or more individuals who may be or include oneself, and transportation, except medicine or religious materials. Well, okay, you know, weapons, lethal substances, explosives, that sounds to me like material support. But what's training, expert advice and assistance? What is that? Well, it probably includes legal assistance. There is a guy, an American citizen, who's on the list for assassination for support of Al-Qaeda activities, whose father wanted to hire lawyers to file a lawsuit in the United States courts to prevent his assassination. But the lawyers were afraid that they would be prosecuted for material support, for giving legal assistance to someone who's targeted for assassination. So they had to go and get an exemption from the government so that they could file this lawsuit. They got the exemption, but the mere fact they had to go seek an exemption is bizarre. Well, there has been a challenge to the statute for the last 10 years, constitutional challenge. And the Supreme Court in June of 2010 issued a decision in the case of Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, which upheld the statute against constitutional attack. The decision was written by Chief Justice Roberts, no surprise, Bush appointee. But Elena Kagan argued the case on behalf of the United States government. Okay? So Elena Kagan, who's now on the Supreme Court, the liberal appointee by Obama, she was the Solicitor General who argued that the statute was constitutional. So that should tell us something to make us very fearful about where the Supreme Court is going in coming years. But the case, if you read it, doesn't involve terrorists. It was a lawsuit by organizations that wanted to help groups on this list engage in peaceful activities. There was an organization that wanted to help the PKK, a Kurdish organization on this list, to help them advocate at the United Nations, to help teach how to resolve conflicts peacefully. to train members of the PKK on how to use humanitarian and international law to peacefully resolve disputes, to teach PKK members how to petition various representative bodies such as the United Nations for relief. That's what they wanted to do. They didn't want to train anyone on how to use guns. They wanted to teach people how to use international law bodies to achieve their goals rather than to fight. And this activity, the Supreme Court said, could be banned. That's the type of support, material support, that this statute covers, that it's intended to cover, and that constitutionally it can cover. And that's very scary. It's very scary because it makes this law so broad. I mean, you have to worry, you know, about anything. Now, the Supreme Court said, no, don't worry about freedom of speech. People are still free to speak out about these things. And if you look at the very last line of the statute, it says that this law is not intended to affect any rights that are protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution. I mean, nothing in this section shall be construed or applied so as to abridge the exercise of rights guaranteed under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Well, the Supreme Court upheld the statute. It is just very scary. This statute, if had been enforced 20 years ago, would have been used against those that supported, as someone said earlier, supported the African National Congress. It would have been used against NORAID, certainly, the Irish organization that raised funds for widows and orphans in Northern Ireland, which the U.S. always maintained and everyone thought was just a front for the IRA, the IRA that now basically Sinn Féin is in power in Northern Ireland. But this would have been used against supporters of NORAID. This would have been used against people that supported the rebels in El Salvador. It would have been used against those that supported the Sandinistas. This is a very, very far-ranging statute, and I'm scared. I'm scared about what's coming down the road. Grand juries. Let me just take my remaining time and talk about grand juries. Grand juries were initially adopted to protect us. They were meant to be a buffer between the prosecutor and the charging decision. In Washington State, under state law, we don't have grand juries. The prosecutor just files by information. There's no grand jury system in the state of Washington. It's used in federal courts and it's used in other states. And again, it was intended to be a protection for us. If you look at the Constitution in the Fifth Amendment, it says that no one can be, you know, held to answer except by grand jury indictment. This is a protection for us. But the system has been misused for years. And there have been a series of times in our history. I'm sorry. I thought I had a loud voice, but maybe I got hoarse yelling last week. But there have been periods in our history where activists have been targeted by grand juries. In the 70s in this city, there were grand juries about the people connected to the George Jackson Brigade. In the animal rights and the environmental movements in the last 10 years, there have been a series of grand juries. If you're given a grand jury subpoena and you refuse to testify, and then you're given immunity, and you still refuse to testify, you go to jail. People go to jail for the term of the grand jury. It's called contempt. And it is very real. People have gone to jail. I guess if anyone here is visited by the FBI and given a grand jury subpoena, the first thing you should do is call a lawyer. Okay? Don't talk to the police. Anything you say to the police or the FBI can be used against you. It can be turned and manipulated against you. Martha Stewart went to prison for lying to the FBI when they came to see her. Okay? The lying to the FBI is a very serious offense. And so, you know, you might think, well, I could just talk my way out of this. I could just say something, argue with them about the First Amendment. No. Because anything you say is going to be turned and twisted and manipulated to make you look guilty. You may not end up with a charge of material support, but you may end up with an obstruction of justice charge for not telling the truth to the FBI. You have a right to remain silent. You don't have a right to tell them something that they think is wrong. okay? You just don't talk to them. You say, I want to remain silent. I want to talk to a lawyer. Say nothing more. There's no such thing as off-the-record conversations. If someone shows up with a search warrant, they have guns, folks. They're going to come in. You're within your rights to ask to see the warrant, but do not attempt to argue with them. They're armed. They have no – they're trained to use force. So you don't argue with them when they come with a search warrant. Okay? So I guess – I don't know. This isn't a very happy end to my talk. And I guess, you know, everything that everyone else has said about organizing and coming together in groups and showing that we care about what happens to people in different parts of the country, that we care about people outside of our own community, that we care about people from the Arab American community, that we care about people from the Somali community who have been subjected to this for the last 10 years. That's really, really important. So thank you very much.
There's a lot of people here, so just, you know, as usual, we'll remind folks to try to keep your comments or your questions short so that as many people can participate as possible.
I was going to ask the brother from the National Lawyers Guild, what recourse have we, besides a constitutional amendment, to get some of these statutes changed, like the Patriot Acts and the Military Commissions Acts of 2006? What do we do to actually overturn these new statutes?
Well, they're not new anymore, but they require act of Congress to change them. I mean, there's either legal battles in the courts, or there are attempts to try to repeal those statutes. And you know, I mean, every time someone from Patty Murray's office has ever called me in the last couple of years, I always say, you know, look, Patty Murray supported the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, as did most Democrats in Congress. There needs to be legislative attempts to repeal those repressive statutes.
So we're a bunch of organizations, and we're not too big on working within the legal system. Are there any ways outside of the legal system that we can be supporting you?
Well, one is within unions, community organizations, other groups, we have been asking for solidarity statements. And we think that that builds a huge wall of defense that the powers that be know that we have support from our communities. So that's the first thing I would suggest. The second is, we are all big on protesting. That might be how they first met us. And we welcome people organizing demonstrations like the ones that have happened here in Minneapolis. We're planning to do an emergency demonstration at our federal courts building when the subpoenas are reactivated. And we'll be continuing to nationally call for demonstrations at federal buildings and FBI offices. And then I think the other thing is to do community education, some of which can happen through processes like demonstrations and solidarity statements, but letting people here in Seattle and people that you know and work with, neighbors and friends and political associates, know about this case and educate yourselves about how to protect yourselves, but also making sure that people are aware in general of the threats to our liberties and that people use all the free speech they got.
Why do they raid the houses? You want to answer? I'll answer. Go ahead.
My daughter asked me the same question. Why did the FBI raid our homes? I'll tell you what she told her friend on the way to this school bus stop that morning. She said, the FBI attacked our house. And her friend said, what are you talking about? And Layla said, it's because we work for peace and they want us to be quiet. I think that they didn't like what we were saying, and they hoped to scare us to so that we would stop saying it. And maybe they believe that we did something that is against a law that's not very fair. But and so they might be investigating what they hope is a crime and hope to prosecute us. But also they definitely were, I think, trying to frighten us.
There was just a national meeting in New York, and I was wondering if you could talk about what came out of that. And who came?
There were about 150 people who met in New York City last weekend, including five of the activists whose homes were raided and were subpoenaed, from Michigan, Chicago, and Minnesota. There were many people from the anti-war movement, from many different national organizations in the anti-war movement, and CISPIS was there, and many organizations that have national offices in New York that are different parts of the social movement. At the meeting, we talked about probably a few things. We did some fundraising, and we were able to raise several thousand dollars that day. We talked about making plans to respond to new subpoenas coming out or being reactivated. And finally, we established sort of a way to organize ourselves in the months or years ahead. And people who want to sort of follow up on it, there were notes posted on stopfbi.net with the details about that. I think we're going to continue to use conference calls and our website to coordinate the efforts of activists around the country. The last thing I'll just say is we did in particular talk about trying to build support for legislative pressure. A lot of lawyers have told me that we're not going to win this in court and that it's a political fight. And so legally we're kind of in deep doo-doo, but that politically we have a lot going for us. And so we're trying to – I mean, I know that a lot – I have to tell you, I have met with a lot of politicians' offices in the last month, and I do not enjoy it. They are very good at avoiding direct requests for help, and they're very good at what they do, which is not what we are asking. Nonetheless, we do think that if we can build up a sort of broad base of support that's sort of popular movement speaking out against this, then it will pressure them to call off this investigation and this grand jury. So we are pursuing that and asking people to assist with that. And this awesome event here tonight, we're looking at more opportunities to take those of us that are being targeted out to speak to people around the country about our case, along with friends and allies in the National Lawyers Guild and others. So.
I'm just struck that these raids, the major raids, occurred in Chicago, Minneapolis, kind of the Midwest. Does that signify anything in particular? How come, no sort of really major raids now on the West Coast or the East Coast?
We're really awesome in the Midwest. But you're awesome here out west too, West Side. I'll say that we believe that it was our organizing around the Republican National Convention in 2008 that began the investigation of the activists that were targeted at this time. That is, I'll say, a guess. They don't invite us to their secret meetings and tell us and why now. There were activists that were visited on the coasts. And those were activists who also worked on that demonstration, those RNC 2008 demonstrations, but were less involved because they were further away. So for what it's worth, that's what we think is when their investigation of us began.
Can you just explain a little bit more they were visited?
For example, a professor in the San Jose area, they knocked on his door at 6 or 7 in the morning and asked if he would talk to them about this case. And they referenced names of the people whose homes were raided and the issue of material support. also at the same day, another person that I know in North Carolina had a knock at his door, and the FBI wanted to talk to him about the people whose homes were raided and this issue of material support. So the visits are basically an attempt to interview people at their homes or workplaces about this case.
Can you talk about the other visits at workplaces that may happen?
Maybe referring to my friend Jenny. Somebody I've known for like 12 years since she was in college at the University of Minnesota. About a week after the raid on my home, her supervisor called her away from her desk and said, "There's someone here to see you." She was called down to a conference room at her workplace where there were two FBI agents who wanted to interview her. She said, "I don't want to talk to you." And they said, "Well, don't you want to know what this is about?" And she said, "Well, kind of." And they said, "This is about Jeff Sundin and Meredith Abbey and Mick Kelly. Those are three of us whose homes were raided in Minneapolis, and how they manipulate people and how they manipulated you. This is about how they have infiltrated the anti-war committee," which I helped start. I guess that's a way of infiltrating a thing. So that's one person who was visited at her workplace. You know, her supervisor knew that the FBI was there. And I think, like, nothing terrible happened at her job, but can you imagine having the FBI coming to your job and telling your boss that they want to interview you about a terrorism case? As the brother mentioned, I think that's happened thousands of times in recent history in the Arab and Muslim community, but it's a little new to the non-Muslim Arab Minneapolis community. So.
Hi, my name is Leah. I wanted to ask you just bring up some of the repression that happened more directly right after the RNC convention and during it against activists working in Minneapolis, bringing people to Minneapolis to organize against the RNC. Who experienced some of the same repression, raids, and charges brought against them under the Patriot Act, charges of terrorism, and whether you know much about what's happening with their case and whether you've been able to ally yourselves with them at all or do any collaboration.
Activists from the Welcoming Committee are great friends. One of the RNC 8, Garrett Fitzgerald, is one of my daughter's babysitters. So these folks are my friends, and we know each other well. They were organizing other demonstrations during the Republican convention alongside the anti-war march, but their own. And in terms of their case, you know, what happened is that their offices, or they had a community center basically set up for activists who were coming from around the country to join in the protests at the Republican convention. Their center was raided, as were several of their homes, in the days before the Republican convention began. And several of them, including Garrett, were actually jailed and missed all the protests, and they then after they were released, as soon as the convention was over, they were released on charges of, it was actually the Minnesota Patriot Act, terrorism charges. Their cases have actually now been resolved. Of the eight of them, three of them, their charges were dropped. One of them took a plea deal this summer, and he had to spend 90 days in jail. And then the other four, is that right? Did I do the math right? The other four, including Garrett, settled their case about 2 weeks ago with, they had to plead guilty to misdemeanor of conspiracy to riot and conspiracy to commit property damage. None of them did any of those things because they were all in jail during all the protests. They didn't have to serve any jail time. They had to pay court fees and do 100 hours of community service. I think that all of them are very frustrated with the outcome of their case and would have liked to be able to pursue it, but to the bitter end, if you will, but there was a lot at risk for them and the possibility of hard jail time. I totally support their decision, and I don't think any activist should have to feel like they have to go to jail for the cause. And in fact, all of them are continuing to do great work in the Twin Cities. We've been able to work together. And the first person at my door during the FBI raid was Garrett, who was still at that time, you know, it was before their final hearing, was still up on these charges. So, yeah.